shared a similar interest in the churches, in the Christian faith's relationship to the question of nuclear armaments, and that the whole issue in our society. And so I guess when they saw me come up, they just figured I couldn't eat a meal without a little bit of indigestion, and asked if I would talk after the meal in a kind of informal conversation, which I'm happy to do this evening, around the issue of nonviolent civil disobedience and the whole question of nuclear armaments. And of course, presumed in that, in my own sense, is the relationship of that faith we hold dear, and what it has to say and where it brings us on that question. And I suppose some of you know, and perhaps others don't, that I did spend 90 days this last year in King County Jail for a nonviolent civil disobedience, climbing the fence in trespass at the Trident nuclear base. On May 22nd of 1978, a group of about 6,000 people had gathered, really encouraged there in the first place by the Pacific Life community, a beautiful community of people in the Northwest who are concerned about human values and hope in the future and the generations of our children, and come, most of them, out of a Christian tradition, a deep and profound religious outlook. Anyway, it was a tremendous experience with these people at the Peterson Farm, where we gathered for a day of celebration and music and consideration of the issue and being together. Such care was taken, for instance, no one could be a part of the action who had not had nonviolent training. And if you were going to be over the fence in civil disobedience, that included several sessions of sustained training in nonviolence, understanding it, role-playing, and being prepared for some of the emotional and practical considerations of it, and also prepared to respond in a way that was befitting the whole nature of it. After we had spent that day, the next day we proceeded over to the base, and about 300 of us climbed the fence, and we got barring letters, which is the letters from the Navy saying you shouldn't come back here, it's the wrong place to be. And so we were dumped out on the street, we were arrested, and in a way booked. So we, nonviolence depends on being in jail for the, in a certain way, for the full round of what the expression is, and or at least, you know, there are several motions. The first is the act of the protest itself. The second is the arrest and trial. And the third is the jail time. And there were some of us that were committed to proceed all the way through the jail time as a way of expressing our intransigence on the issue. And so the second day, we were booked again, and this time indicted, and then left out on our own personal recognizance until Christmas time last year, and we had a trial in front of the federal court, and the judge said to 172 of us, they finally, that was all the indictments they had. They had made several clerical errors on the rest of the 100. They booked some dogs, and they booked the names of dogs or people that had been dead for 10 years, or there was some jollying that was done, federal people. But anyway, 172 indictments were handed down, and we were found guilty, and we asked if we could waive, the judge gave us a suspended sentence, which is to say, we're not going to send you to jail, I'm going to sentence you to 45 days, but if you're good for 3 years, you don't have to do that time. And if you break that probation, you'll have to do those 45 days, and then you'll have to stand trial for the next act. And those of us who felt it was important to make the point inside of jail asked the judge, no disrespect, Your Honor, but is it possible to waive the probation? And the judge said, no, it wasn't. They were afraid that they would have too many to feed and house. And so we were forced then, if we were going to go the full round, to commit another act. And so we had two different jeopardies. We had to serve the first time, 45 days, and then we went to trial again, and we had to serve a second time. Well, that's just a little bit about it. I could tell you so many things. I could tell you about the deep religious commitments of many of the groups that were formed. They formed affinity groups, small groups that were formed to study the issue, to study the roots of our own thinking, and get acquainted with each other in depth, and then to participate in this larger experience. It's the same way the protest that will be organized for October 28th and 29th at the Trident Base is organized. And so a group out of Campus Christian Ministry at the University of Washington was organized to look at the issue and to think about what the faith said to it, and then to consider the tradition in the Christian history of nonviolent civil disobedience and what that might encourage for us in it. I could tell you about the moments of prayer and profound sense of community and hope that we experienced in taking an active step to express our own convictions. For me, one of the frustrations and the points of despair is that I feel that something is going on that I have little or nothing to say about, and find no expression that seems suitable. I write letters to all my congressional people until I just pace the walls with them, you know. I'm sure they're tired of hearing from me. A couple of times a week, probably, on average, the Washington Congressional delegation on different issues. And on the nuclear armament issue is one of them. But I felt in some stronger way I wanted to testify because of my sense of the future of my children and my grandchildren and all the world's children, that that there's no future in the kind of thing they're doing in proliferating these armaments. So Bishop Hundhausen calls it the number one moral question of our time. And you know, I'd rather play Monopoly and watch the ball game on Monday night and forget about the whole thing and live my usual life. But I feel like I can't do that. I have too great an obligation to the future. I have too great an obligation to look my children in the eye and say, I've done what I can as a human being to say, there's death in that. That's the trust in the eon of death, as Paul calls it, and we believe in the promise of life as it was expressed in Christ, and that is that the way through is a willingness to endure even to the cross and to suffer and to trust in the weakness of love that's willing to suffer as the way to the future, and not in the power of violence, to put not our trust in the weaponry and destructive capability. It's a fundamental question, it seems to me, around the truth of the Christian faith. Is it true that the cross is the power unto salvation? Not just some otherworldly salvation, but the future of the world. If that's true, then the weapon system, the nuclear weapon system, represents a faith that says the cross has no power in the world. You know, what Henry Jackson says is, if you're a realist, this other thing is just silliness. That's what he says, to believe that the power of love that's willing to suffer is the power to the future salvation of the world. And on the other hand, the way to do it is to arm, is to have bigger and better bangs that can wipe out massive numbers of the world's people in order to protect all our shiny white refrigerators and all the wealth that we've accumulated and we're uneasy about in the face of the world's need. And I think that's the key question. I want to keep coming back to that in my own mind. What do I believe in? Do I put my ultimate trust in violence? And if I do, then the Trident system makes good sense. And that's the way the world is organized. Or do I put my ultimate trust in, am I willing to risk my future and my children's future on, you know, what I sing hymns about and what, in a way, I have wanted to commit my life to, the power of the cross to salvation and to eternal life. And you see, I believe that has not only a transcendent meaning, that is, for the future eternity and eons of the world, but it has a meaning for our life right here and now. I'd like to talk just a moment, too, about the Trident weapon system, because even though it's really I get depressed thinking about the whole shooting match. I think it's important on two grounds. I think the Trident represents a threat that we've never really faced before in weaponry and the insanity of war in the human tradition. One is that it's such a massive weapon system. I wonder if we really realize what the government in our name and with our tax dollars is building. Do you know that we have 13 submarines on order right now, and each one of these has 408 warheads on it? And each warhead, each of those 408 nuclear warheads that are independently targeted, are five times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. That's one submarine worth, $2 billion. They talk about why there's inflation, why inflation are eating up pension dollars, you know. It's right, it's in buying weapon system like this. But 408 independently targeted warheads on each submarine, each one five times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. Now, it's past comprehension, it really is. People that have been at Hiroshima, as Mark Hatfield says, one of the most profound experiences in his life was to be there and to understand the threat to humanity that this kind of weaponry represents. And I've just read enough about it. I'm not erudite in any way, but I've read John Hershey, I've read accounts of the Hiroshima blast. I've talked to Hiroshima victims. I've heard them testify in court. Our government has suppressed a great deal of the threat to humanity. And yet, even so, in Pentagon testimony before Congress has said that if we fired off a submarine's worth of those weapons, 80 million of the enemy that we're targeting those missiles at would be wiped out, men, women, and children. And we've agreed in the Geneva Accords that indiscriminate weaponry is outlawed in the world. And yet, what is the atomic weapon? It's indiscriminate, of course. And not only 80 million of their people, but 15, 16 million of our own in what's called, in the Pentagonese, acceptable collateral damage. That is acceptable collateral damage that 15, 16 million of us get shot while they're shooting off 80 million of the enemy. Now, this is in a, you know, to me, when you begin to build a weapon like that, it's immoral. I guess, again, every time I rehearse that fact, my blood pressure rises and I begin to get on a pedestal, and I need to remember that preaching against it isn't going to bring it down. In some way, it's a force of human hope and something else that will bring it down, our encouragement for a different kind of a faith and life in the future. And I see signs of that stirring, and that's what's hopeful. Well, I wanted to talk first about the massive threat that the Trident weaponry represents. And you know, the radioactive fallout, by the way, and background radiation that's produced by nuclear energy is minimal compared to what's being produced daily in weapons production. That's another thing. Each nuclear energy plant produces enough plutonium in 2 weeks to make a bomb. And the U.S. is making bombs at the rate of about one every day and a half, atomic bombs. We have now estimated enough to do in every available target 50 times over. Overkill. That's the amount of nuclear stockpile that we have. And Russia has enough, it's estimated, to do 30 times at any target they have. So again, I can't see the sense of it. What are they making all these nuclear bombs for? Well, the first element is the massive nature of it, and the second element is that the Trident represents a dramatic change in nuclear weapons policy. That up until now, basically, it could be argued that our weaponry is defensive. It's aimed as a kind of retaliation for any blow that's aimed at us. But the Trident system is a whole frontier, a new and frightening escalation, because it was developed with tremendous amounts of dollar. The former missile system was accurate to within one-third of a nautical mile. They could put that warhead that was five times the Hiroshima size on a target within one-third of a mile of it. Well, now you know you land a weapon that's five times the size of the Hiroshima weapon, within a third of a nautical mile, you aren't going to, if you get it within a third of Holden, you aren't going to leave much of Holden left, right? It'd be just a bleak landscape around here. If you even landed one on Seattle, I heard testimony in court from people that are skilled in that Vancouver, B.C. would be well wiped out, a good portion of it, through fallout and the problem. That's from one bomb. But the tremendous money was spent not to make it accurate to within a third of a mile, but the Trident is accurate to within 90 feet. And why did they proceed to do this? Robert Aldridge, who was the chief design engineer for the Poseidon series and the initial lead design engineer, one of the initial lead design engineers on the Trident series, said the reason was is that they wanted what's called a first strike capability, that they could hit the other missiles while they're still in the concrete silos. And you don't want to hit the other silo when it's empty. You got to hit it first. That's the threat. And so what you're standing there is with a weapon that you really have to use first to use its full capability. And it's called a preemptive strike. They don't like to use the word first strike, the Pentagon in testimony. They call it a preemptive strike weapon. And that's what has frightened even such people as Daniel Moynihan. I think it's what's brought Billy Graham on board, if you've seen the recent issue of Sojourners. Mark Hatfield is talking about it. He has a beautiful amendment he's proposing to SALT II, which talks about a nuclear moratorium. It's on those two counts, the count of the first strike weaponry and the count of the massive threat, that really led me to say, I've got to find a way that's nonviolent, that shows respect to the law. It isn't disregard for the law. It's respectful because it depends on the function of the law to make it point. It says, I'm going to break the law, I'll suffer the penalty of the law, and by this I'll show you how deeply I feel about it. And then I can just tell you that what was a profound experience for me, as I've expressed before, is the support and community that we have in the Christian church around the country and the world that I felt in those days in jail. The sense of encouragement in the faith from the leaders in our community, the whole, our own, Gibb has been a tremendous support. And I know he takes a lot on account of it, and I just got to admire his courage, but his willingness to put it there on an important issue, as well as Archbishop Hunthausen and Bishop Solberg and Jim Halfacre, Youth United Church, Bishop Cochran signed as the Episcopal Bishop. It was a remarkable confluence of Christian leaders in our community and met, many of whom met in the 300 who were there at the jail when we had a tremendous service on May 9th when I got out. Well, it's somewhat confused and overexerted, but that's a start anyway, and I'll respond to questions so you see where I was coming from on it. And
John,
yeah?
I have an idea in my mind that hasn't yet dissipated, and that's the idea, you hear about overkill.
Mm-hmm.
You say we have 50 times overkill and Russia maybe has 30. My idea is that those missiles will cancel each other out, and so then no one gets hurt. Do you have anything to say about that? they hit each other and blow up and everything's okay.
I don't know why, but I do have an underlying sense of hopefulness. I know that God's answers to human problems very seldom come in the way that we think they'll come in human history. It's a doctrine of the absurd, I call it. A beautiful doctrine of trust in, and if we are faithful ourselves, we're called to faithfulness and not to have a political answer or not to know how it's going to work out. And so just such an absurd, it could be that some kind of absurd scenario. I don't know where the answer is, but I do know that on the other hand, we're called to testify to our hope against where people are putting their hope. That's trust in the god Moloch. That hope that's represented in the Trident system. And we trust in a whole different god of justice, the god of care for the most vulnerable in our society. If there's any strength and anything to hope for and anything to have confidence in our country, It's in a community that takes care of the most vulnerable. That's where we ought to be at work. If we really are afraid of our future, we ought to be considering our care for the earth, our care for the ones that are hurt and wounded and homeless and hurting in our society. That's what will make us strong and so powerful the world can't resist us. And you know, I heard a wonderful talk by Paul Ramsey last year who said, just think of what would happen if the U.S. said, hey, we're not going to disarm everything. We're not talking about a radical step, but let's take a first step. We're going to call a moratorium here, and we're going to take the money that we would have spent this year in development, the billions we would have spent in development of this these nuclear systems, and we're going to put that in a world fund for development of the underdeveloped nations, and we're going to challenge Russia to do the same thing. And you think about the wave of sanity that would break on international politics and the pressure for that to continue and to escalate. All of us little people saying, hey, right on, you know, I can see you spending my money for that. Let's quit buying these foolish billion-dollar weapon system where the contracts go to who knows what, and we're building obsolete weapons anyway. Let's do something that's rational and sane, and there would be a tremendous wave of I think, political encouragement for that kind of sanity. And maybe the world is poised on the brink of such a possibility. I think it is. It's waiting for us to say, hey, let's do it, and to put the pressure there in our own little way as we can to encourage it. So your question.
Okay, my question was absurd, I agree.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if there's any factual basis for that kind of belief.
I've never heard anything like that.
Okay.
The only thing, you know, you hear the argument that it's a standoff. That's what the idea is, that it's a standoff militarily, and that it's been a pox Americana because of our strength in the world.
Yeah.
Are you supportive of SALT II?
Well, I am for some reasons. SALT II doesn't represent any significant arms limitation, and I have a lot of uneasiness about it in the loopholes that are there for both sides. But as the Swedish ambassador to the United Nations, I talked to him about it, quoting a good authority on it. He said to me the really important thing about SALT II is the mechanics that it sets up of conversation. That if you're going to have any real arms agreement, that you have to have a mechanics of observation and conversation between the governments that SALT II represents. And so it isn't the reduction or the limitation that's any good. That's not worth the paper it's written on. But what it represents is a possibility for a future to be enacted. And therefore, it would be tragic if we don't enact it, I think. But we need to proceed immediately to SALT III or whatever it is.
Yeah, what happens if in the process of trying to get votes for SALT II, the MX missile system is used as a way of buying votes for SALT II? Is it still worth it then?
Well, I don't know. I'm perplexed on that, so I don't know the answer to that question. I think we got to sin bravely in that regard and say, let's. I wouldn't vote for. I don't want them to vote for the other, but let's have the mechanics anyway. And there are people, even Reagan, if you notice in Time magazine this last week, I heard read some account. It's not a great source to quote, but Reagan is making noises about about we've over militarized, and it astounded me. See. And I think that they're, but there's a growing sensitivity in our society that things are awry in that regard, and that we haven't paid a close enough attention. Carol, you had your hand up.
Yeah, what was the Hatfield Amendment that you...
Okay, the Hatfield Amendment is a beautiful amendment that's proposed right now. It's a nuclear moratorium. It says we're going to... not only sign SALT II, but we want to propose an immediate nuclear moratorium for the U.S. and Russia to say we won't develop any more missile systems for a specified period of time. And it just takes the pressure off. There's the cruise missile system, and the MX are both being pushed for development. And the Russians, on the other hand, are there's a great feeling that in 77 they offered a similar thing, and that they would respond to this ploy because they're feeling the groan and the strain of this on their own economy. It's basically a nuclear moratorium.
What's the status of that?
Well, he proposed it last Tuesday in front of the Senate committee. You know, for whatever it's worth, I saw the PI with a strong editorial in favor of it, Jack Doty. Are there others who can? I don't think, given the what I can sense is the congressional disposition right now, that it has much of a chance. But I think you know that again, there's when the Triton protesters started out at the Triton base, there were about 30 people there, four of whom climbed the fence, and the next year there was about 14 who were a part of the civil disobedience, and maybe 100 people who were there with them at the gate. And the next year there were 6,000 with 300 in civil disobedience. And this October 28th and 29th, there will be similar protests in Groton, Connecticut, and in Georgia, and in Sunnyvale, California, where Lockheed makes the components, and up in Michigan, where the grid is, communications grid is being implanted in the earth. There's a strong, growing community of people, and so I think that the movement is politically viable. Yeah. Paul,
John, yesterday, 200,000 I heard were gathered in New York, and I guess Bill Lazarus of our LCA has gathered some scientists and some ethicists. Have you related with them, or how does what your specificity on the Trident issue related to what we're doing as a Lutheran church in America?
Okay. There's been a sense of collegiality in it, but not any specific cooperation on the issue. For instance, there's a Lutheran peace coalition out of New York. There's a kind of common concert of understanding and knowing each other. But you remind me that there are different emphases on the issue. Now that I didn't see the paper this morning, but as I understand it, that was more directed toward the nuclear energy question. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
And you know, we're well aware that strangely is a much more politically alive as an issue right now. People were frightened by 3 Mile, was it? And they also see the tremendous expenditure of public funds in the nuclear generation, right? WWPPS or whatever, WPPSS. You know, billions of dollars into the future is committed for nuclear power development, and afraid of the radioactive fallout or such things as happen at 3 Mile and other possible risks. A couple good books that I could recommend, by the way, are Dr. Helen Caldicott's book, Nuclear Madness. That goes into the danger of background radiation from both power generation and then, of course, the armament buildup. And then Jim Douglas's book, The Nonviolent Cross. It's a beautiful expression of the Christian faith and its relation to the nuclear issue. And we're called to. But your question, back to your question about cooperation with Lutherans, nothing official, okay? But people wrote, you know, Elmo Argumson, Herb Chilstrom, Talk to Lazarus, and others, you know, we're in concert on the issue. It's kind of like you don't need an organization when there's just a lot of people vibrating in the same tune.
What about in our synod? Have you?
I haven't taken any steps. I'm not the greatest advertiser or promoter in that sense of organizing. But I think we know that, you know, John Lemnitzer. John, I'd like to have you say a few things about your experience in the Montana scene. John has been very active on that issue with others in out of Missoula, and maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the experience you've been through there. We know there are many others that are involved in it around our Senate.
Well, I guess just had a lot of quite a growing momentum, at least I sense that.
Yeah.
People that I've been in communication with, and surely in Missoula and Montana, we have 200 Minuteman missiles, and we're trying to do some resistance against the presence in Montana. We've done a number of things. We had a service on August 6th, an anniversary of the dropping of the Hiroshima bomb, and some civil disobedience then, and we did something last Easter, service at Maelstrom. Maelstrom Air Force Base is kind of the heart of the system in Montana, and we hope to do other things coming up in the future. So, you know, the presence is there, and the presence is being felt throughout the state, and people are aware of the nuclear presence in Montana. And I guess just continuing the whole dialogue with people in the church is so important. At Senate and here and where we gather together is to know possibilities and what we can do. We've got a tremendous amount of, so many things we can do if we just take a risk and just let it happen.
I think that, yeah, right, you just point out again, the first step, you know, is really to get educated on the issue, to learn about what's being built and what's being done. And if people can encourage that process in their congregation, I don't think that there's a risk in that, to say this is an issue we face, let's learn about it.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'm a promoter, I don't know. You know, I try to bring materials. I've got some good materials if anyone wants to continue. We passed a resolution at Senate on just continuing education. They're unwilling to go beyond that, and that's kind of sad, and that says something about the delegates and about where our synod's at. We had a resolution on civil disobedience, encouraging and affirming people, not saying that you had to do it, but to allow people within the church to do that if they feel so called. And that wasn't passed, it was kind of tabled, and we hope to deal with it tomorrow evening. But I do have some material and some excellent resources that can be used in your parish to continue the dialogue or to begin the dialogue and to just discover, you know, the menace that is before us. And, you know, it's hard to believe, but, you know, when we look at the MX and we look at people are really wanting to invest in that 200 new weapons, you know, it's incredible. It's hard to believe that we're still there and this is what we expect. That we expect this is going to help defend our country from everything that Russia wants to throw at us. But I think if we do take the risk, and if we do take the chance, the first step of saying we're going to stop, we don't care what you do, we're going to stop in favor of the continuation of our humanity, our future, you know, I think it would be a tremendous, you know, what it says throughout the world if we stop producing these weapons. And we can do that. We're far enough ahead where we can stop producing these things. And then we enter into the whole dialogue with the troops in Cuba. We don't want to vote on this system because they've got a couple troops in Cuba. You know? How many troops do we have around the world right next to Russia? It's crazy. You know? It's unbelievable. And yet, we have a president who comes in who says he's going to be in favor of zero nuclear weapons. And what does he do? Where does he end up?
But we've got to build a constituency for him. That's
sure.
The point. You had your hand up?
Yeah, there's at the world level, obviously, you look for signs there, too. And the World Council of Churches called a world conference on faith, science, and the future at MIT this summer, and I was an official participant for the Presbyterian denomination. Though the nuclear disarmament was not on the agenda per se, it got on the agenda very quickly because it is an issue of faith, science, and the future. And so one whole afternoon was allocated to that issue. And out of it, of course, came a statement. Not that it's a big thing, but it was a statement calling for complete nuclear disarmament. But in the afternoon, one of the people was attempting to try and create within us an image, a mental picture of the size. And I'd like to share part of that with you and then extrapolate it in my own head with you, because I certainly will never forget it. There, the July issue of the Scientific American has this article on what would happen in a case of a nuclear war. And it's an article that should be distributed because it does sort of forecast what will happen if we start such an event. We have 6,001 megaton atomic warheads in our arsenal in the United States. 6,001 megaton. Hiroshima was 1/60th of a megaton. A megaton is 1,000,000 tons of TNT in terms of explosive power. How much is 1,000,000 tons of TNT? The way to find that out is loaded on a train and see how long the train is. So how long is a train of 1,000,000 tons of TNT? And you finally discover, my word, it's 300 miles long. Okay, that's where the man stopped. My head kept spinning. And so I multiplied 6,000 warheads times 300 miles, and I got 1,800,000 miles of railroad trains. And then my head kept going, and I said, well, how can I visualize that further? So I started walking up the west coast of the United States, and every 3 or 4 miles I started a railroad and ran all the way to the Atlantic in a grid every 3 or 4 miles all the way across the United States. And I filled all those trains with TNT. And that's roughly 1,800,000 miles worth of TNT. That's how many bombs the United States has in terms of explosion. And the pathetic part is that isn't even the problem. The problem is radiation. And we're building one every day and a half.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody asked me, okay, up there.
I'm from Pennsylvania. My folks live 10 miles from Plymouth Island, and all my family lives there. But I don't think people realize some very important things, and that's the real danger as far as radiation isn't from nuclear power plants. If you remember when the Chinese set off a bomb a number of years ago, the thing they were worried about at Plymouth Island was radioactive iodine. And the fallout from the Chinese bomb that came over those whatever 5,000 miles was 50 times higher than the iodine, radioactive iodine ever was during Three Mile Island. Well, I don't think we can comprehend the effects of the bombs.
There's a new study out now relating the SAT scores of students who were in the womb during the 50s, and we had all kinds of fallout, and there's a direct correlation now. And that study is just now starting to be released. Just fantastic. Beyond, you know, statistical probability.
Appreciate that. That's why I'm such a dumbo.
Now you got an excuse.
John, you made the statement that something to the effect that you felt you had to get the jail sentence in terms of actually serving time. What's the holiness of that?
Well, I don't mean to make it anything holy. It isn't very holy. It's a pretty shabby work.
Not for a holy guy like you.
But, you know, it's one thing. People just say, well, you're going to court, but you must have a good lawyer or something like that, you know. When you hit jail, I think I could sense in my neighbors, general acquaintances, that it was taken more seriously. I really meant it. And I think that's, And Gandhi, you know, has shown us that. King showed us that. It was filling the jails, putting people in who don't belong there, you know, in a sense that they aren't disrespectful of the law. In fact, they're on behalf of a good society. It's confounding to the whole system. It's very irritating to the system. But it's a profound way to move. And it's a profound power. It really is. And we haven't begun to tap that yet. A willingness to just make some moves, some mild risks even on that behalf. When you begin to feel what's possible that way, and it's beyond any comprehension of a small little act that you may feel, it's remarkable. And what could happen if a number of people would get that kind of vision and say, you know, I can see it for myself. What do I have to lose? It's a way to say it. And it'll be good for me. Not only that, there are whole other fallouts of things. We belong inside the jails by way to see the way that system works. That's a whole other question. It's a way of praying. Jail time is a way of praying. It's a way of saying, I want a different, you know, Lord God, I see a different future. I'm praying for that here. It's a tremendous way to, if you feel your prayers are dull right now, you ought to pray in jail. You really pep up. That's seriously. Yeah.
Having been there, has your fear of jail diluted?
No, I have mixed emotions, but they can't frighten me with it anymore. I don't want to go back immediately. My wife says the next time she gets to go to jail and I have to take the kids. But I want to speak to the kind of sense of wholeness I felt. I felt God's presence in jail, in a sense of it was appropriate for me. I felt a real kinship with people that I'd only vaguely understood before. You know, people whose massive commitments make any small little act like that seem silly, but like Bonhoeffer and King and a remarkable host of others whom you begin to read about and appreciate. People in the Barman Church through the difficult years in the Hitler time. And we had, some conversation with the folks who had been through that. One old pastor's widow wrote me from Germany a tremendously supportive letter, understanding nonviolent civil disobedience in that tradition of the Barman Church, you know, see. That's to be a part of, again, a company of faith in a way that just, to me, I just feel privileged in my life to have experience that, and I want more of that. I want to be faithful, and it takes it takes a certain amount out of you too. There's no doubt that it demands things of you, but you're given that strength and a support community of people that help you through it. It's remarkable. So, yeah.
John, I've heard you talk a lot about the sense of wholeness and community that you've experienced. And now you just mentioned a little bit about, you know, that it does take energy. I'm just wondering if you have had any idea, if you ever get spooked, or if you find that people are kind of in opposition, that you run into a hard resistance. One, just as an example, I heard that one of the delegates at the Senate convention, this is third hand, so I don't know if it's true, but it was announced that you were in jail. You had been in jail because of the Trident, and someone said, "Well, he should still be there in jail for all I care." And I'm just wondering.
That was me.
Majority of the ladies are in my parish.
Sure. And then they don't know me on the Indian fishing ranch, is you? So, I recognize that I guess it doesn't win. That's another kind of understanding of the gospel, though, that it works as a leaven, a salt in the midst of a larger loaf. And a lot of time I can respect and understand those people. They're frightened. They don't understand it. They don't have a background out of which to understand it. And I think, you know, from where they're coming from, it seems like a disloyal act or irresponsible. It challenges all the things they want to hold dear and their place of where the future is. They have good instincts about it, but I just feel like children, they don't see the larger picture. That's my understanding of it. And so I want to do it in a way that isn't lacerating to them or acerbic. You know what I mean? I don't want to do it with hostility or damning them, because that's not helpful. I want to do it really as a sense of joyful taking part in God's future. And come on, understand, this is where it's at. Let's get on board. This is where the celebration is. And that's what I've experienced, and I'd like to invite people in on it. And I think even those people that are now dramatic in their hostility can be brought along. I think Billy Graham is a tremendous example of that, you know, that came to a leader. Yeah.
What you have said so far is all fine. I have only one problem with it, and that is that somewhere along the line we've got to keep in mind there is always a possibility of the risk of acting for the gospel, of losing one's life completely. And this is also a very tremendous possibility. I'm not saying it's a probability, I say it's a possibility of total annihilation of our country and its people. If we're pursuing this now, see?
Right.
And why I'm bringing it up, we're taught that
by our faith, that the risk is to death. Right.
Right. That's why I'm bringing it up, that we should never forget that.
No, sir.
That if we, whatever steps we take, that if we're doing it for the gospel, that gospel also requires perhaps the giving of our lives, as our Christ did.
But you know, Ilvesacker sang a beautiful song, and he understood King's life in that way. They can't kill me, I've already died.
That's right.
They've lost their chance, our fate to decide. Through baptism, we've died to the world, in a sense that we put our ultimate hope in the success of this world or the accumulation of things or all the credits. And that our trust is in the life that's eternal, and we've died to this worldly life through baptism, and we've risen to the new life, and therefore what do we have to risk? Now, I only grasp that, you know, in a fragmented way, I think. But I really appreciate your raising the issue, because all of us, through our baptism and through the faith, that's what the final call is. But when we learn it, that not as a threat of fear, but as the joyful freedom that we have nothing to lose, because our bank account isn't here, really. I mean, it's precisely here, but it's here in a way that's eternal. That's the life that lives on. Then we can take part in this thing, and we aren't frightened by atomic annihilation. That may be an act of God to bring on a new tomorrow. We have to see it that way. There's a kind of an absurdity in that. But
yeah,
it's a very important
reminder that we
okay
got to keep that
right
in our mind.
And we don't have to have a political success. I'll get you.
I'm interested in your personal pilgrimage, and wonder if you could go back maybe 5 years and tell how John Nelson has changed from 5 years ago in terms of your thinking, and then project ahead maybe 5 years where you're going. Did you anticipate 5 years ago that you would be in jail in 1978 or 79?
Well, I've had intimations of that along line on different issues. And having been involved in the campus and on anti-war protests. So I've seen the threads of that. I knew even when I came to Seattle from Montana that I would be involved in a kind of escalation of the elements of national issue. Not that they aren't there in Missoula, they're precisely there. In some ways they're as vividly as anywhere else, but I could see that in my call here, given my own disposition. I guess that's a long question that I don't want to bore people with my personal track right now, but it's arisen. You know, my mother's as much to blame as anybody.
May I tell them one little story at this point?
Yes,
Rather than that,
okay.
When we never permitted guns in our kids, we never gave them toy guns. I've hated war, you know, so anything he's blamed for, we should really get the blame for, because that was the atmosphere. But anyhow, he was had come home from school one day, and he had a swollen lip, and he was looking in the mirror. He's about 8 years old, I guess. He's looking in the mirror at this swollen lip, and I said, well, John, what happened? Oh, he said, I turned the other lip.
I had to laugh at Mom when I told her about my decision to take part. She said, well, if I love you, and if I were there, I'd be climbing a fence with you, and I do hope you're a model prisoner. Denny, you had a question.
It was more serious than that.
Okay.
When the comment was made here relative to the risk and that, I think that recently I read a document that came out of the UN. I don't know how, I didn't realize until I read it, that the 70s was set as a decade for disarmament by the UN. And within this document are a number of people from throughout the world who spoke to the nuclear disarmament issue. And one of the things that came across there was that, I wonder if you could address this, the risk involved. I've been in Great Falls for a year and a half, and I think that the underlying issue and that needs to be resolved is the issue of the fear of the communists.
Right.
And I'd just like to have you speak to that for a while, because that to me is the real issue, that we have bred this country to fear the Russians. And the whole propaganda related to that, do you feel that, we agree that the statement here that the risk is annihilation. Is that really the risk? Is that really the risk that we'll be annihilated? Do we really believe they would annihilate us? Is that the mentality of Russia?
Well, I think there's a serious fear that, that they're aggressive and world building and might take over our government and force us either to be subdued or to go through mind-bending processes of one kind or another. It's I don't want to glorify the Russian scene at all. I think it's a frightening prospect of tyranny that I can see being enacted there.
Well, one of the things that came out in this paper by people that are represented from Italy and from other countries is that many of the negotiations in the UN related to disarmament are that the Russians have consented to go so far,
US,
and the United States has said no.
U.S. is very often has been the one that has submarined those possibilities. Right.
So then, why do we look at them as the aggressor and not see ourselves?
Well, that's a good point. That's number one, that we really need to understand ourselves and the history and world armament considerations. That time and time again, we've developed new systems. We talked about land-based systems last time on the first SALT agreements, when we were all the while building a whole nuclear arsenal in the submarine things. A second point is this, that is the point about that Ramsey made, is that if we could, we don't have to put a radical trust immediately and just completely unilaterally disarm. If we could just show a wave of sanity for the future, that would have a powerful snowballing effect. Doesn't that seem like a reasonable proposition? That's what I'd like to meet some of the people who say, well, why don't you go to Russia and go to jail, see? And the third thing is that in every way possible, the church is trying to make its voice heard on both sides. We've got to do it where we are. That's what I believe. I've got to do it where I can. Now, there's an old man in Seattle that wants to get a fishing fleet together and go to Kamchatka. His name is John Ronning, and maybe he'll do it. He's a Quaker and a beautiful guy, and he's willing to declare himself an international citizen and to be put in prison in Russia in order to make this an international thing. There may be that kind of vehicle coming up. But I don't know how many of you have seen the document of the World Council of Churches called Choose Life. Did it come out of that institute at MIT?
No, it came out before that.
Okay, but it was signed by Dorothy Marple of our LCA, by people from our churches, both east and west, around the world. It's a beautiful document. If you did nothing more but got that document and studied that in your church, that's a fantastically hopeful and strong statement that we, as a human race, we've got to stop this. And it spoke to both governments, that we can show that the church is speaking on both sides at some risk. That's another way to answer it.
What's that document, John?
It's called Choose Life. And it's a document of the World Council of Churches, and I'm sure it'd be available through our, through Kneebank and Lazarus in New York. John?
Yeah, I just want to say that the topic for the next Synod Convention is the prophetic voice of the church, if I'm not mistaken. I've been in communication with Philip Berrigan about the possibility of coming out to be keynote speaker, or one of the speakers for that, for the convention, and he said he would come out and participate if he wasn't in jail. So, you know, we might maybe talk with the people on the executive board and see if we can encourage an individual like that who could come out and address this issue. You know, he's got just a tremendous commitment to it, and he's been working and struggling for a long time.
Yeah.
And he would be a very beautiful person to have. So, you know, I can encourage maybe some of you who maybe know some of the executive board members to encourage them to support this.
Well, I see that our we're just about time for Vespers, so I want to thank you for the good conversation, and I get a hopeful sense out of the meeting like this.